Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Hi, Teresa. How you doing?
I'm doing well so far and avoiding so far what you're carrying around with
That's
you this
right.
week. Hopefully we can make it through the show and your voice will hold out. We'll have to...
Yeah, that's right. I hate to end up talking about church history like Kermit the Frog or something, but I'll get to this as best I can.
We'll try to keep feeding the liquids and see what else we can do. But anyway, we have covered the French Revolution, and last week we discussed Napoleon.
Yes, and Pope Pius the VI and Pope Pius the VII.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, even if I were suffering under laryngitis, I would try to croak through this thing because we are entering into a really, I think, an exciting period of church history of recovering from the French Revolution, from the Napoleonic period, from the Enlightenment, the skepticism, all of those things. And we really have to center in on France. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in France, and it's very, very complex and countervailing sometimes. But I think if we would constantly, as we look at this, always remember what some historians refer to as the two nations of France.
Okay.
We talked a little bit about that before.
We did out in the country and then in the city of Paris.
That's right,
The red and white?
The red Frenchmen or the white Frenchmen, the socialist communes, Paris. So keeping all of that in mind, and then also understanding that within those groups there are subgroups.
Okay.
So there's constant alignments and realignments that take place. And I thought maybe as I was thinking about how to do this, I thought let's start out by looking at two people at the time of the French Revolution who were contemporaries. One was considerably older, about 30, 35 years older than the other one, but they lived during the same time. But the way that they lived their lives is so different that I think juxtaposing the one with the other, we get a sense of this development of the two nations of France, two very, very different understandings of France and of the church in France.
Okay.
And so the first one that we'll be looking at, and I had promised early on we were going to take a look at this guy's life. His name is Charles-Maurice de Talleyrand-Périgord.
Oh, yes.
Of course.
He keeps coming up, doesn't
he? He keeps coming up, yeah.
He just
lived a long, long time. He escaped the guillotine several times, and so he's one. But the other one that we would love to turn to and use as an exemplar of a very different sort of French Catholic is a young fellow born in 1786. So in other words, 3 years before the French Revolution actually began, right? And his name is Jean-Baptiste Marie Vianney.
Okay.
And so looking at these two men, St. John Vianney and Talleyrand, and looking at their lives, I think tells us an awful lot about France at the time and after the French Revolution and how two people could go through this experience and come up so different from each other. It's a fascinating story.
All right.
Fascinating lives.
Let's do it.
So, well, let's start out then with Talleyrand.
Okay.
And 1789, remember that's the time that the king calls together the Estates General. The French Revolution is now beginning. And one of those traveling to Versailles is a 32-year-old bishop, Bishop Talleyrand. And he is riding high. He is one of those aristocrats that we had spoken of before, those up in that up and coming class. He is so typical. He was born in 1754 of noble family. At the age of 16, he was sent to Saint-Sulpice to study for the priesthood. And so there he did. Eventually, after completing his studies, was ordained by his uncle.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who was the Archbishop of Rheims,
one
of the great cathedral cities of Europe. And he was 24 years old at that time.
24?
24 years old.
Okay.
You know, not extraordinary. It's pretty typical. Yeah.
Yeah.
2 years later, he was given a real job, and that was in 1780. He was appointed by the king at the recommendation of his uncle and a number of others. He was appointed the agent general for the clergy. That is to say, he becomes the spokesman for all of the clergy in France at the court.
Oh, okay.
So that's quite a role for
a
26-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, recently ordained and all. He continues that. Oh, I should mention also that he did that during the daytime. At night, he snuck off and joined the Freemasons, was inducted into the Freemasons.
Oh, okay.
At the age of, he would have been in his early 30s, he was made the Bishop of Autun, a very prominent diocese in France. This at the recommendation of King Louis XVI.
Okay.
So here you have, once again, one of those times in which it still continued on in the pre-revolutionary France, where the nomination of a bishop basically came through the king.
Okay.
And through a committee that called the Committee of Conscience, if you remember.
Oh,
St. Vincent de Paul had been a member of that, recommending candidates to the bishop to recommend candidates to the Pope for for bishop. So anyway, in 1788, he becomes a bishop. Less than 1 year later now, he is now brought to the Estates General. And as a member of the First Estate, he's 35 years old.
Okay.
Okay, so he's young and energetic. He's got a great life ahead of him and bright future. At the Estates General, he is one of the first bishops to break ranks with the First Estate and go over to the Third Estate to join in the National Assembly that was formed over at the tennis courts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You remember Abbe Seya and others had organized the Third Estate, and he is one of the first to do that. So, and what you're going to find with Talleyrand is all along his entire lifetime, he has a very keen sense of things about to change, and he is always right on the cusp of that change.
Okay.
He never gets caught behind. One teacher years ago had told me, one of my college profs had told me, and I've never really spent time to look this up or not, but he said that Talleyrand from time to time would go on a private retreat. Now, it wasn't necessarily a religious retreat, but it was a private retreat in which he would lock himself into a room and not see anybody for days on end. His servants would bring food and put it outside of his door, but he wouldn't have anything to do with anybody, and he would just mull over personalities, people, things, events, what's going on. And then when he would leave, he'd clean himself up, go back to work, and then all of a sudden he would do something that would be very, very strange, but it would be right at the moment when something was about to happen.
Hmm.
So he has this uncanny sense of knowing which way the wind's about to blow.
Okay.
You know, and certainly this was one of those examples.
Uh-huh.
You know, so he was right on top of that. He gets involved in the National Assembly. He, of course, along with everybody else, is brought back to Paris. Remember when that rolling riot went out there and out to Versailles and then pulled everyone back. He is one of only seven bishops. Only seven bishops will sign the Civil Constitution of the Clergy. He is one of the first to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He engenders himself then as a constitutional clergy. If you remember a week or so ago, we said that the revolution ate its own church.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that Fouché and Hébert and others turned on it. He very quickly slipped out of town and left France in 1793. He now becomes an émigré himself, but he does not join up with the other émigrés. These are white émigrés.
Uh-huh.
You know, these are people who had supported the monarchy. These are bishops who left and fled France. Pronouncing an anathema on the French church. He, on the other hand, is one of those revolutionary bishops, and so he's not received, obviously, by those others. Now, what happens is that he ends up spending almost 3 years out of France looking for an opportunity to come back. And after the overthrow of Maximilian Robespierre, the radical Jacobins, in the what was called the Thermidorian Reaction, the new government, the Directory, was looking around for somebody who was really good and could help them with their foreign affairs. And so they asked Talleyrand to come back and become the foreign minister of France, which he does in 1796. he's very good at what he does, and he certainly makes a lot of money for himself by what he does. Because part of the deal was, in order to get in to talk to him, you had to pay a bribe, a little gift.
Yeah.
A little gratuity of sorts. One of those to do that was a delegation that was sent from the United States. Because if you remember, we just fought the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. This is in the 1790s. We're a very poor country. We're still operating, just now barely operating as a republic. We had been the Articles of Confederation.
Okay.
And so we're just trying to put our act together. We're trying to maintain some kind of relationship with these countries. We've been now at war with Great Britain, our mother country. Our ally was France, but wait a minute. That poor king who gave us all that help is now dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sent this delegation over to negotiate with the French. And what happens with Talleyrand won't even meet with the American negotiators until they pay this little tip. And they got all worked up about it and wrote back for instructions. And, of course, this is where that famous phrase came out, millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. Not one penny for tribute. And it was actually Bishop Talleyrand. He's not a bishop anymore. He's not operating as a bishop. But Talleyrand had pulled that off. At the age of 45, in 1799, it looks as though he's set for life. He's a foreign minister of a major European country, meeting with all kinds of muckamucks and mm-hmm. all this kind of thing. And interestingly enough, he just sort of disappeared out of the scene and reappeared a couple days later with a general. Now, this general had been sent off to Egypt to mm-hmm. beat the British and to break their empire, and he's just returned home and announced that he won a wonderful victory when, in fact, he had lost a terrible defeat.
Right.
And came back to announce that the government was corrupt and he was going to overthrow the government in what became known as the coup d'etat de Brumaire. And, of course, this is Napoleon Bonaparte. Mm-hmm. Standing at his side is Talleyrand.
Talleyrand, okay.
Isn't that something? And, of course, with that, the Directory simply shriveled. Mm-hmm. Those who came along with Napoleon survived. Those who didn't headed off to do other things. But okay. Talleyrand is
once again, standing with the wind of change, as you said.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, for that, he's duly thanked by Napoleon, and he maintains his position as foreign minister. Not only that, but Napoleon gives him a very important task. As I mentioned before, Napoleon realized that France was a Catholic country.
Mm-hmm.
He realizes that the people of France, being so Catholic, had prevailed against all odds against the Revolution. And so he realized that France could only be great again if it were Catholic. So with that, he gives Talleyrand the task of negotiating a treaty with the Vatican to bring about a normalization of relations, which of course becomes ultimately the Concordat of 1801, mm-hmm. Which we talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
Once that was negotiated along with Cardinal Consalvi, the Pope then rewarded Talleyrand by normalizing his own life.
Mm-hmm.
In 1802, he was laicized.
Okay.
Okay.
1802.
He's 48 years old now.
Okay.
That gives... So now he's in good standing with the Church once again. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He then heads off to the east, to Russia, to negotiate another treaty. This one is the Treaty of Tilsit, which is a terribly important treaty between Russia and France. And basically, it's a non-aggression pact. They agree that they won't attack each other. They agree that they'll cooperate with each other. Napoleon is at his height.
Okay.
There's nobody that can oppose him except for Great Britain, who's mm-hmm. hanging out there, and Portugal, of all things, is an ally to Great Britain. But everybody else in Europe is either now a forced ally to Napoleon, or they're occupied countries that are allies to Napoleon. Usually he's got a relative as their king or potentate or mm-hmm. whatever, or at least they're neutral.
Right.
You know, so he is riding high. And Talleyrand is riding high.
Yeah.
And John Vianney is riding high.
Ah.
He's just old enough now to go to school.
Okay.
And just luckily, the priest in his little village has just opened a school.
Okay.
Now, the school is specifically for boys from the village who the priest believes would possibly have a vocation to priesthood.
Okay.
So he wants to start preparing them for, basically, it's a pre-seminary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so he invites a number of these boys to come to his little school and begin studying. His name is Father Bailly, and he is a great friend of Vincent de Paul throughout his life. He believes John Vianney. He believes that John has a vocation.
Okay.
He also recognizes that John is not the brightest light in the candelabra.
Okay. Okay.
And so what he did was he helped arrange so that some of the other students could work with and tutor little John Marie.
Okay.
One of those, interestingly enough, is his Latin tutor was a friend of his, same age. His name is Matthias Laura. And unless you're from Dubuque, you wouldn't make much difference.
Okay, it's not triggering anything for me.
Yeah, but he came to the United States,
okay.
And he became the first bishop, the founding bishop of the Diocese of Dubuque.
Oh, all right.
And John Vianney was his student.
His Latin student?
His Latin
wow.
student.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it didn't help. He couldn't learn Latin worth a darn. Anyhow, so while he was struggling in school and not getting a great success, his contemporary, mm-hmm. Talleyrand, was getting a great success.
Mm-hmm.
He won the Treaty of Tilsit. Napoleon was so excited about this treaty that he gave to Talleyrand another title. And the title was Vice General Elector.
Okay.
I don't know if that necessarily means anything to anybody. But it meant something to Talleyrand to be called the Vice General Elector.
Okay.
And also to Joseph Fouché. Remember the secret police?
Oh, thing? Yeah.
He responded in the following way. He said that that Vice General Elector, that was the only vice that Talleyrand did not have.
Oh, big supporter, huh?
Not much.
Yeah, right.
Well, the success was short-lived.
Okay.
That's
okay.
Napoleon attempted now an economic union, a bloc, in which each of the parts of Europe would trade with each other, sort of like the EU today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea is that there would be one nation excluded from this bloc.
Oh, yeah.
Great Britain.
We know who they are.
Yeah. And by doing that, he hoped to be able to reduce the British.
Mm-hmm.
Nation after nation signed on. They had
okay.
to. Ultimately, everybody goes along with him except for two countries. And one of those is a really big one, Russia.
Ah, okay.
You know, they're more than happy to have a non-aggression pact, yada, 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 mm-hmm. all that. But Alexander I of Russia is a young, very energetic, and very idealistic Tsar,
uh-huh.
and he's not going to go along with this. And mm-hmm. so he maintains his independence. Ultimately, that's going to lead to very bad tensions between the two countries, and Napoleon will invade Russia
okay.
in 1812, which
mm-hmm.
we're well aware of. The other country is not particularly vital to the economic well-being of the continental system, but it just really ticked the emperor off.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Papal States.
Okay.
Now, you know, Pius has no particular reason to side with Anglican England,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
but once again, Pius refuses to allow himself to be used as a chaplain in Napoleon's army,
uh-huh.
and he maintains his independence, and so there's that. That ultimately, as we know, is going to lead to an invasion of the Vatican, the arrest of Pius VII, and then for 7 years he'll be held in captivity. It makes life hard on the Pope. It would have been easier for him just to have rolled over,
mm-hmm.
but he's nobody's puppy dog, and Pius VII stood up to Napoleon. Well, when Napoleon marches this incredible army, a 500,000 men, it's the largest army in European history at the time, marches this 500,000 men, the Grand Army, across Europe into Russia, when he does that, he also takes a lot of troops away from other areas
mm-hmm.
that would have kept them under control.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was Spain.
Oh.
And with that, the Spanish rose up against his brother, who he had placed as the king there. So the French now had to raise another army out of France, new recruits, to send down to Spain to put down this revolt. One of those recruited was John Vianney.
Oh, okay.
Young boy, you know, teenager, but he's drafted. Everybody in his class, his you know graduating mm-hmm. eighth grade class, so to speak, is drafted. And so he reports to the local reporting station. His unit is pulled together, the uniforms, or the arms, the munitions, the officers, everything's there. The unit is formed together. And John Vianney thinks to himself, well, I better go over to church and pray. So he went over to the church and to say some prayers before he got shipped out. When he got back to the barracks, they were all gone.
Ah.
They left without him. So he was, what am I going to do? So he runs around and he finds a recruiting officer.
Okay.
And he reports himself. He says, I missed my unit. I was overstaying some prayers, you know. And the officer goes, oh, I can't believe you, big dummy. Okay, don't worry about it. As long as you catch up with your troop, you're fine. If
okay.
you don't, you're deserted.
Uh-huh.
And he says, well, I don't know where my troop went. And so the officer gave him another young boy, and the boy promised to lead John to his troops.
Okay.
Okay, so off they went out into the mountains, heading toward the Pyrenees, you
okay.
know, the crossover into Spain. And they're walking and walking and walking, and it turned out that the kid misled him.
Oh, my
gosh. He didn't take him to the troops. He told the officer he knew where the troops were going and he would take John with him. He didn't. What he did was he took him up to a little village way up in the mountains called Noé. And in this little village, it's where all the French deserters were gathering. There were like a dozen or more of them.
Oh,
that
my
had deserted
gosh.
From the army, and they were hiding out. Now, the mayor of the town was against the war,
okay.
and so he was giving them protection.
Uh-huh.
He was hiding all these people.
Uh-huh.
So along comes John Vianney, and this kid comes along and says, here. And, you know, he's going, wait a minute, this is my troop. What are you doing? And the mayor says to him, he says, don't worry, just hunker down. Everything will be fine. The war will be over in no time. And you just stay here. And, by the way, can you read and write? Well, not Latin, you know. He goes, well, I've been to school. Yeah, well, Father Bailey. And he says, well, good, because we need a school teacher.
Oh, my God.
Believe it or not, John Vianney became the school teacher in this little community. This went on for a little over a year.
Wow.
He hid out for 14 months.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, sure enough, the mayor was right. The war came to an end.
Uh-huh.
The troops came back home. And basically the deserters left and melded in with everybody else.
In.
And he could have gotten away with it, except his dad found out.
Uh-oh.
John Vianney's father found out, and he was ballistic about it. It was just not a nice scene. But nonetheless, he's able to get back home and resume his studies
okay.
once again. Well, let me tell you this. He's not the only deserter.
Uh-huh.
Not only those other deserters who were up in that village, but this guy by the name of Talleyrand was already in the process of deserting.
Oh.
He was meeting with representatives of the enemy.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that something? He was meeting
something
with representatives
else.
Of the Russians, of the Prussians, of the British, of the Austrians, anybody that would talk to him, giving him all kinds of information on how to beat his man, Napoleon.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, why was he doing that? He figured Napoleon.
He wanted to be Napoleon.
Yeah, he wanted to be on the right side.
Uh-huh.
Well, this is the one time that Talleyrand made his move a little too quick.
Uh-huh.
And Napoleon found out about it. And before he could get his hands on him, he simply fired him.
Oh, okay.
As foreign minister. So he survived it.
Okay. Wow.
So what happens now is that Talleyrand heads over and he joins up outside of France. He joins up with the brother of Louis XVI, Now, okay. Louis XVI, remember, was guillotined.
Mm-hmm.
He has another brother. I believe it's a Pian's brother. I don't know how he ends up with the name Louis also. But he's taken the name Louis the 18th.
Okay.
Because Louis the 16th's son would have been Louis the 17th, but of course he was not able to succeed to the throne, and he died. So Louis then takes this title, Louis the 18th, and continues on the Bourbon dynasty.
Okay.
Talleyrand is now rallying with him, working for him, and acting as his chief negotiator with these allies.
Okay.
Okay, while this is all going on, John Vianney gets back home.
Okay.
He has to listen to his dad,
you know,
give little talks, and then he goes off back to the school to study and take the exam to get into a seminary, and he failed.
Oh,
he failed the entrance exam. A couple months later, he finally passed the second one, and at the age of 29, he was now ordained a priest.
Okay.
He's ordained by the Bishop of Grenoble.
Okay.
Now, that's over in eastern France, southeastern France, not too far away from the Swiss border. But this is one of those things that, if you remember Chieti, a couple centuries earlier, it was like one of those cities where everybody kept coming back to Chieti. Remember Cardinal Carafa?
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Theatines founded, St. Cajetan, a whole bunch of saints all attached to this little Italian city.
Mm-hmm.
Watch and see Grenoble in the 19th century France.
Okay.
People keep popping up around Grenoble.
Okay.
And here's our first example of it. The Bishop of Grenoble ordaining a man who has no future as a priest.
Okay.
And yet he ends up being one of the great saints.
Right.
And in fact, the patron of diocesan priests. Yeah. Well, so he's then ordained. It's pretty obvious that he's sent back to Father Bailly to be his assistant.
Okay.
So this is a wonderful thing for Father Bailly. I mean, he saw this boy, and saw a vocation in this boy, and then constantly worked with him, helping him through his studies, and now he's been ordained and sent back to be his own assistant. What a wonderful thing. So while this is going on, and everything is just wonderful down in the Diocese of Grenoble, Talleyrand is now being sent to Vienna as a representative of Louis the
18th. 18th, okay.
Now,
okay.
He is so good, he convinces all these people who have been fighting for 26 years. He convinces them that they should accept France as an ally.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, something? I mean, when you think about it, this is like pulling off a coup, like at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
If some German negotiator had negotiated with the Russians and the British and the Americans and the French, and at the end of the war, you know, at the meeting at Potsdam, if one of the Germans had been one of the negotiators.
Mm-hmm.
If Germany had not been divided as it was in 1945, but rather was acting as one of the allies that had won.
Uh-huh.
You go, what? You know, or Japan, rather than being defeated in 1945, we would have turned around and said, oh, it was a big misunderstanding.
Uh-huh.
Come and join us as an equal. This is what Talleyrand pulled off. It is absolutely phenomenal.
He is incredible.
Yeah, he really is. And so from then on, France would remain one of the four or five movers and shakers of European affairs instead of being a beaten force that had been, you know, pummeled. Well, while he's scoring this incredible success at Vienna, John Vianney, now the assistant, the associate of Father Bailly, takes an exam to enter into theological studies.
Okay.
He was ordained with a minimum of theology.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so he takes the exam, and he fails.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately for him, this is 1818, the same year, Father Bay dies.
Oh, okay.
So he no longer has his ally, help him through all of this. The bishop, not being able to be petitioned by Father Behe, now finally makes a decision as to what to do about this poor priest that cannot get into theology. Just can't do it. And his decision is to send him out to a tiny little village to be the pastor out there and just quietly spend the rest of his life being a country priest. And of course, the villages are. It's not too far from the city of Lyon. 32 years old, he now becomes a pastor, but of not much.
Right.
And so he heads out there with very little, except for all the incredible spiritual gifts that Father Bailey had seen in him. And that's what he's bringing out to this village. He has, and he's famous for it, very deep spiritual insight. He is one of those who could read the souls of men. You know, a person could come into confession to him, and we've got so many testimonials of this, come into confession to him and pour his heart out about something entirely different. And Father Vianney could say, but in a word, but aren't you really concerned about this? And open the man's heart, or the woman's heart, in a totally different direction. The other thing, too, about him was that he absolutely lived a virtuous life. Virtue was natural to this man. So he arrives, and it's through pure example and exhortation that he begins turning the village of our, which is, I guess, probably about 300 to 500 people in the whole town, begins turning them back toward their faith. They had had so little to bring them to their faith. They knew so little about their faith. They were sort of like cultural Catholics. They just did it because it was there, but they shaved all the edges that they possibly could. You know, they're the LIFO Catholics. You know, LIFO and the last in, first out. Sunday Catholics. They were basically like that. He recognized that one of the biggest problems in this village was the fact that there were so many girls that didn't have families. They were like little orphans running around, and he wanted to do something for that. So he set up a house for destitute girls, and he referred to it. He called it La Providence, Providence. And eventually, there were a couple women that became very interested and took this on themselves, and they formed their own religious order. There was one woman in particular. Her name, in fact, is Mother Marie de La Providence. And she organized this little order of nuns called the Helpers of the Holy Souls. And what they did was they had this little orphanage for girls to help them through their time. It didn't take very long before word got around, as the different farmers and artisans of R came in contact with other people, they began bragging about their priest. Word got to the city of Lyon that this was a man who could read souls. And so people began coming out to R in order to go to confession to him, to be spiritual directed under him. And more this began happening. The word spread from Lyon throughout France. And even internationally, people traveled from throughout Europe to come to just consult with John Vianney on some of their great life decisions. One of the things he did also was he set up a little catechism school for the kids in the town. And the kids, he was so simple in the way he taught the faith. You know, here's a guy who could not get into major theology school, you know.
He didn't need it.
But on the other hand, he could come to children and express the faith so simple. I remember, what was it? I think I was reading about the Catechism of the Catholic Church, one of the early, the one that we have today, one of the early drafts was given to an elderly Italian cardinal to read.
Okay.
And I believe, if I remember the story correctly, that he came back a week or two later with the draft and gave it back to, I don't know if it was Cardinal Schoenbrunn or who it was that he had given it to, but anyway, he gave the draft back, and the other cardinal said, "What do you think of it?" And with tears in his eyes, this old Italian cardinal said, "This is my mother's faith." You know? And so it's not the complexity of theology, mm-hmm. but it's the simplicity of faith. That's, yeah. you know, it's that deposit of faith that's passed on from generation to generation. And John Vianney does that. You know, he does that very simply to the children who are so taken up with this, they tell their parents. So that he ended up having to open his church at nights and teach catechism. He had to use the church because it was the largest building in town. It was, you know, the people just came in droves mm-hmm. in order to learn their catechism from him. While he's doing all of this, events are happening up in Paris. Mm-hmm. In 1830, the King of France, Louis by now has died. His brother, Charles, takes over. Charles the X. We'll talk a little bit about him later on. He's overthrown in a revolution called the July Revolution. Big events in Paris. No one knows what's going to happen next. Ultimately, another king is chosen, a member of another. It's the same royal family, but it's a different line. The Orleanists, and that's Louis Philippe. He becomes the king of France. Two of the people who stand by him and help him do this in this relatively bloodless coup are none other than Talleyrand. Mm-hmm. And also the Marquis de Lafayette, who's a very old man at this point. Anyway, Talleyrand then is rewarded by Louis Philippe for having done this. At the age of 76, he becomes the ambassador to Britain.
Okay.
Goes to London there, spends 4 years there.
Wow.
At the age of 80, he is on his deathbed
mm-hmm.
in London. He sends for a priest.
He did.
And receives the last sacraments.
All right.
And here's a guy. I mean, it's come full circle.
Yes, definitely. Circle.
Yeah, yeah. That also is the last year, 1834, is also the last year that John Vianney is allowed to attend the diocesan retreats for his diocese.
Why?
The bishop of his diocese said at that point, from now on, you cannot make a retreat with the other diocesan priests because your life is a retreat.
Oh.
You don't. There's nothing we can give you, A. And B, I don't want to deprive the people who need you of that week.
Oh, my gosh.
He speaks of the souls waiting for him yonder. And so with that, John Vianney was not allowed to attend diocesan retreats anymore. Well, understandably, he was, in the last years of his life, receiving as many as 20,000 pilgrims a year coming to him
wow.
for spiritual direction.
Oh, my goodness.
He spent all day in confessionals. We know of this.
Yeah, and right.
This is what he's famous for, yeah. Mm-hmm. And finally, on the 4th of August, 1859, he died.
Mm-hmm.
15 years later, Pope Pius IX declared him venerable. And in 1905, he was beatified by Pope Pius X, who recommended him as a model for all parochial clergy.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1925, yet another Pius the 11th, then canonized him.
Okay.
He had lived throughout the first half of the 19th century in a France that was full of revolutions and revolutionaries, and also a France full of saints and full of Marian apparitions. During his own lifetime, there had been three major apparitions that had taken place. First of all, in 1830 in Paris, with Catherine Laboure.
Mm-hmm.
We'll speak a lot about that a little bit later mm-hmm. on. In 1846 at La Salette.
Oh, right. Oh, my goodness.
Which is a little tiny village not far away from the city of Grenoble.
Oh, okay.
And then in 1858 at Lourdes.
Mm-hmm.
to all three of these, he was a contemporary of.
Wow.
I'd like to talk about some of these other saints that were contemporaries of his.
Okay.
And one of those is a young girl who was born just about the same time that John Vianney, as a little boy, entered into his own studies with Father Bailey. And her name is Marie-Victoire Corderc.
Okay.
She was sent away to school as soon as she was old enough and came back home from time to time for visits. And particularly as a teenage girl, she came back home for a visit at the same time that in her village a priest had come to give a mission. Remember, this was a very popular thing.
St. Vincent de Paul started that, right?
Mm-hmm. And of course, Francis de Sales is famous for his missions, too. Well, anyway, at this little village, there was a priest by the name of Father Stephen Terram.
Okay.
Who came, gave a mission. He must have been a very dynamic person, because by the time they finished the mission, she wanted to go off and become a nun.
Mm-hmm.
And he had already founded a small order of teaching sisters known as the Sisters of St. Regis.
Okay.
And in southeastern France, around Grenoble, this order of sisters was teaching and conducting Christian schools. And she wanted to join this. Well, she went to ask her father if she could, and her father went ballistic. He said, ain't no way.
Mm-hmm.
And he refused to have anything to do about this and all. Well, you know, she was persistent, and daughters have a way with their fathers. Ask Catherine Labouré and any of a number of others. And so she was finally allowed to go and join the Sisters of St. Regis. With Father Terram. And at that point, then she was given the name Sister Therese.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Her first assignment, and turns out her only assignment, was in a little village of La Voulec.
Okay.
And what was interesting about this was they had a small school set up to teach the little children, little girls in the village. They had sisters there. But La Voulec is interesting also because it is a site of a pilgrimage. Many of the farmers in that area every year would go to La Voulec and to a particular shrine to pray for good crops for the year. It was just a custom to do that. The problem was that it was a tiny little village, and they only had one or two little inns, and they could never accommodate this hundreds of people that would come to descend down on the village every year. So what they did was they would open up the church, and the women who came on the pilgrimage would sleep in the church.
Okay.
And the men would sleep around wherever, and in some cases men and women were sleeping together in the inns, and it was just a big hodgepodge. It was such a mess. And in fact, the sisters themselves would open up their convent to the women. And since there wasn't enough beds in the convent, they would get straw and strew the straw all over the corridor, and the women would sleep in the corridor.
Oh, my God.
It was terribly disruptive.
Oh, sure.
You know? So Father Terram gets the idea of building himself a little hostel.
Okay.
A little place that would be set up specifically for the people to stay.
Uh-huh.
Great idea. But he didn't have much money.
Uh-huh.
So he ended up building a really small hostel.
Okay.
And sure, within the first year, it was overwhelmed.
Too small.
Too small. And it was chaos. So Sister Therese, who evidently is a take-charge kind of a woman, gets a hold of this priest and gets him aside and says, this can't go on like this. We've got to change things around. What should we do, sister? She says, look, we'll take these women into this hostel. Us sisters, we'll run the hostel. And we'll take these women in. But only the women that promise to come here and be silent during this time. They're not allowed to talk. They're not allowed to carouse. They don't go out and, you know, have drinking that night and then come on back. And, you know, this isn't a, you know, a body house. It's not a, it's not a motel. This is, you know, they're going to be here. They're going to be here quiet, silent, and they're going to be here because it's a pilgrimage and they're going to be praying. Mm-hmm. And that's the bottom line. And Father Terram goes, great idea. So the next year, the word went out, any woman who wanted to go over to the hostel that was run by the Sisters of St. Regis better go over there and understand they're going to keep quiet, there's going to be silence, it's going to be a prayerful attitude, they're going to be praying, and it's all going to be about the pilgrimage. And they did. And it was a great experience.
Oh, okay.
And more women wanted to sign up for it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they had a waiting list of women who wanted to do this. Well, while this is all happening, Father Terram comes back one day, and he's gone off and done an Ignatian retreat, and he is all excited about the Ignatian exercises, which he thinks is really great for the sisters. So he then makes sure that they go through the Ignatian exercises themselves.
Okay.
Sister Therese, particularly, is really taken up with the discipline of the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola. What she does is she takes those and she changes them around and makes them more suitable to the women who are coming to her hostel for this pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm.
So the next year, the deal is this. You're going to come to this hostel and you're going to be silent. It's going to be a prayerful atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And we're going to go through the Ignatian exercises with you.
Okay. Eh?
You know what she's just done? She's just founded the retreat movement.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And after, you know, what happens is that these women go, they go back to their own villages and go, you wouldn't believe what an experience I had. This was so great. And other women go, well, gee, I want to go too. And so what they do is they say, look, we only have this 1 week a year for this project. It's not going to work. And so what they did was they began opening the hostel up all throughout the year. And women would come and make week-long retreats all year long. But that meant that some of the sisters couldn't teach in the school because they were doing the retreat work mm-hmm. instead. And finally, Father Terram, Sister Therese, sat down and they go, you know what? We can't go on like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did was they then basically broke the order into two groups.
Okay.
And the sisters who wanted to continue teaching little kids,
mm-hmm.
they continued as Sisters of St. Regis.
Okay.
And the other sisters who wanted to do the retreat work full-time became the Sisters of the Cenacle.
Okay.
And that's how the Cenacle sisters come mm-hmm. about.
Neat.
And they have, of course, impacted
the
church in incredible ways. First of all, you know, over 150, almost 200 years now of offering retreats for countless numbers of women all throughout the world, and not only women, men also.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think also along with this, and I've not come across any particular studies that would show this, done scientifically, historically, but I have a real feeling that what they did and how they did that impacted on the whole retreat movement
mm-hmm.
within the Catholic Church.
Right.
Certainly what the Jesuits were doing with their own retreat centers and with the Ignatian exercises. But I really think that the Cenacle sisters have a tremendous impact along that same lines. She eventually will die in 1885 in the city of Lyon.
Okay.
The other thing I think I should mention, too, about Sister Therese is that her own spirituality, you know, conducting retreats for all of her, basically her adult life, she herself had an opportunity to do a lot of prayer, a lot of contemplation, meditation, and thought, and some writing also. And I think that if you boiled everything down, and in fact you can go to the websites of the Cenacle Sisters, and they talk about the retreat centers, and they talk about Sister Therese, and about the history of their order, where it came about, and how it came about. But they also have other subsections that talk about her own spirituality and her own insight into the spiritual life. And the bottom line, I think, for her was a recognition of God's abundant goodness. And that's what she discovered during the retreats, and that's what I think she wanted to do to these other people that came to her retreats, was to recognize God's incredible love for us, and that it's there in our entire lives, but it's made all the more conscious when we're in retreat and everything else is peeled away from us, and we're able to concentrate on that. Mm-hmm. And with that, the great joy of being alive in God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. There's a great little quote. Let me give you this quote. She says, "Oh, if people could understand beforehand the sweetness and peace enjoyed by those who hold nothing back from the good God, you know, mm-hmm. those who hold nothing back, they're full of the joy, okay? How he communicates himself to the souls who sincerely seek him and who know how to surrender herself. Let them just experience it, and they will see that therein is found the true happiness which they vainly seek elsewhere." So the whole concept of making a retreat then is to experience God's love, to taste that, and then to see that all this other stuff that they left behind out in the outside world is vain and mm-hmm. it falls away, and then they come back to that world with a whole new direction,
right.
A new set of direction. That's the goal of a retreat then, is to experience God's communicating goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, she was no Pollyanna. I came across another quote that mm-hmm. That she had that was really good. Evidently, you know, life wasn't exactly too easy on her.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the following, I think toward the end of her life, she said, "If we had known what we would have to suffer, we would have picked up our shoes and started out, and we'd still be running."
Yeah.
Why isn't that for sure?
That is.
Yeah. You know, take a look at these saints all living at the same time. Okay, we've got John Vianney.
Right.
We've got Thérèse Corderc.
Okay.
She's born in 1805.
Okay.
We have born just before her, 2 years before her, Peter Chanel, and we'll say some things about him. He's not as well known as most of the others, probably because he died in a far-off country at a relatively young age. But it says something about the evangelization that is just beginning to take place in the 19th century that's so important.
Right.
Born a couple years after him, 1 year after Thérèse, and 3 years after him, is Catherine Laboure.
Okay.
And also, I put him in as one of the French saints. He's actually born in Spain, but he'll die in France. His name is Anthony Marie Claret.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So here are five saints.
Mm-hmm.
Five saints, all living basically in the same area at the same time, doing very, very different things.
Yeah, they are very different lives, which always interests me, and they are all at this time, and we see that they do come in waves like this. Do
yeah.
we know of any of them interacting with each other?
No.
Okay.
I thought that I had come across a quote, and unfortunately I didn't take notes on it, that John Vianney had some comment about one of the apparitions during his lifetime. And I went back to my sources and I could not find that. So I'm not going to comment on it because I don't know all
that.
No, no.
Okay.
Except for the proximity.
Right.
You know,
right
the
there,
proximity.
Huh?
Once again, when you take somebody like Peter Chanel, he's born in a small village called Bailly in France. It's about 50 miles away from the city of Grenoble.
Okay.
Again. the work that Mother Thérèse did was in that same area,
okay,
around
uh-huh.
that same diocese of Grenoble. La Salette, mm-hmm. the apparitions taking place around Grenoble. So it really is, if there's anything, it's something to do with that.
That area.
That area, that ground.
Fertile something. Ground, right?
Yeah, the water, I don't know.
Okay.
But I think then as we come back, our game plan will be then to look at the lives of these individuals. I want to hold off on Catherine Laboure little bit, and I have a method to my madness, because Catherine Laboure has the gift of an apparition. She's given an apparition, but it's not a happy apparition necessarily. And what what follows after that, and this is also a very, very tight secret. This is not something that we know an awful lot about the miraculous metal today.
Yes.
But this was something that was not widely known in her lifetime. Even though the devotion to the miraculous metal was, very few people knew that she was the source of that apparition.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a tightly held secret within her order.
Mm-hmm.
But it has tremendous political implications. La Salette, incredible political implications. What really comes out of La Salette is an apocalypse,
yes.
A statement that's made and is proven true within a few years, and tremendous implications. Lourdes is tied in, interestingly enough, with the cure of the emperor's son.
Mm-hmm.
So those, and then later on, once again, the emperor. There's another apparition that takes place way over on the other side of France in Brittany, that saves a little village from a Prussian army in the Franco-Prussian War, the War of 1870. And so all of these are kind of interwoven one with the other. But what we're going to do is, after we look at these saints, I want to step back and give an overview of French political history of the 19th century, which is really very chaotic. But only by understanding that can we really understand what the heck Mary was doing in these apparitions.
Mm-hmm.
These things, I am convinced, when I look at them within the fabric of French political history, these things were not just appearances.
Mm-hmm.
There was a method to this madness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we will see that. So once we look at the chaos of French political history, the woof and weave of the whole thing, then we'll go back and take a look at the apparitions and see how each one of those gives an indication of what's about to happen and what we should be preparing ourselves for.
All right.
Okay.
That sounds great.
Good
to look forward to.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Father. Shall we close with a prayer and your blessing?
Let's do. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless us in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.